Welcome to Don't Pass Me By with me, Bob Wilson. Whoa, what a show we have today. I guess you could say good night, America. Good night, America. We have on Robert Groden and William Mattson Law, two guys who have taught us a tremendous amount about the assassination of JFK. A lot of the facts have been hidden from the public, and they try many ways to twist them and hide them and get rid of them. And we can thank people like these two guys for coming forward, so that we can find something out about our history, our true history. So William has some books out there. He has Betrayal, a JFK Honor Guard Speaks in the Eyes of History and at the Cold Shoulder of History. I recommend them all. And Mr. Groden has books like The Killing of a President, High Treason Part Two, The Search for Lee Harvey Oswald, and more. His reputation speaks for itself. But I understand, Mr. Groden, it started all back in Forest Hills High School in Queens. Is that true?
That's true, sort of true. That was the period of time, but on that particular day, it was my birthday. I was 18 years old that day, and I was playing hooky. So theoretically, it didn't happen exactly at Forest Hills High School, but it happened at that time.
Well, I mentioned that in part because it's your history, and in another part is I don't know if you heard of a little town called Richmond Hill, New York.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Down by Jamaica Avenue and the J train and such. And to get to my high school, which I also missed often as you played hooky, it was we would take the ERF train when we did get there. So I also hail from the neighborhood. I also noticed you were in the army from, I believe, 64 to 67. What led, if I can ask, what led you to sign up for service?
Well, I was really affected by the assassination of the president. I was feeling really, really lost. I took it very, very, very personally, and I joined the service to change my life and things. So that was the reason why I joined. And as it turns out, I was very lucky because the timing worked out where I did not have to go to Vietnam.
Well, I wouldn't want to be running around the jungle myself and having bullets fly over my head and running around that kind of a war that seems to have been fought for no good reason. So I'm with you on that one. We're glad that you're here today and that you were able to avoid that one. But as you said, now at this early time, though, not everyone thought there was a conspiracy at that time. What led you as a young man to think something was amiss in the case?
Well, the fact that I was playing hooky that day had a good part of it because I was at home and I had the TV on and I heard the very first reports. I believe it was NBC. And the first report said that the shots were fired from an office building and the police were chasing the assassin across some railroad tracks. Well, being from New York City, I grew up most of my life at that time before we moved to Queens. It was New York. So to me, in my mind's eye, I pictured this grid, north, south, east, west, like that. And they said that the railroad tracks were behind an office building. So in my mind's eye, I figured that there was a row of buildings and behind that was a row of railroad tracks. Well, I knew I heard it. I wasn't crazy. I was amazed that a few hours later, all of a sudden, they were saying that the shots came from the building alone and mentioned nothing about the police chasing anybody across the railroad tracks. Everything had changed in just a few hours, and I knew something really crazy was going on. And I started to study what I could, everything that was written, everything that was on TV, everything that was done. A lot, most of it was cover up anyway, but the few things that did get through really made me stop and think. And I read some of the earlier books like Rush to Judgment and Whitewash and Accessories After the Fact and just a whole bunch of those. And there were people that had discovered there were more things going wrong than I did. So I took all that in mind. And then the fact that I had been archiving all the photographic evidence that had ever been released and quite a bit that wasn't. And I put two and two together, and through fate, I ended up working for a company in New York that had done 8 millimeter film blow up to 35 millimeter. For the Woodstock movie. And Life magazine found out about that, and they brought us the original Zapruder film to see if they if it would blow up and retain resolution. And we blew it up, and we did a great job with it. And needless to say, an extra copy was made they didn't know about, and that's what I released on Good Night America.
So that's fairly amazing. Now, you're a young fellow from Queens. You joined the Army. You come back and you're, you know, working with footage, and what stumbles into your purview but the Zapruder film. Now, can I ask your feelings when I would be, if I hadn't seen it before or told about it, I would be quite stunned. What went through your mind as you saw this film for the first time?
Well, the most obvious thing, of course, is frame 313, the moment of the fatal headshot, and then the president's reactions to that right after that frame, where the president is thrown back for eight frames to the rear seat. Now, we were being told that the shots all came from behind, from the Texas School Book Depository, and that the president was thrown forward. Dan Rather said that on CBS. And as it turns out, the film shows the exact opposite took place. When the president's hit in the head, he's thrown to the rear. The calculated rate of acceleration was 100.3 feet per second as a rate of acceleration. This could not happen with a shot from the depository. This had to come from the right front, which was from the grassy knoll. That which has become known as the grassy knoll. It's a hill that was to the president's right front.
Now, as you learned about this, remind us, please, your age as this is happening. And when you go home with this information, are you savvy enough to keep it to yourself? I would be tempted to call my friends and say, hey, do you know what I saw? At this stage of your life, how did you handle that, seeing something that was so sensitive and potentially, you know, so many people had strange experiences with dying in the case? This is quite a bit of information for a fellow to be seeing. So how did you handle what you saw at first?
I didn't tell anybody. The only person who knew was my wife. I shared it with her, and I figured for safety's sake, I should not let anybody else know. And I didn't for several years. I didn't release the film publicly. Well, I did in 1975, but it wasn't covered by the news, and it was just in a very short area of time and a very short position, which was at Georgetown University. And everyone who was there was just astonished by it. But it never picked up, never went public. So I shut up again until later 1975. It was 1975. I released it on television after I had released it for the first time. I did it a second time in Boston at a conference called The Politics of Conspiracy. And when I did that, it was picked up by the news media and it became a national story. And I met Dick Gregory there, and he said, we've got to do more with this than just this one symposium. And I said, well, what are we going to do? And we discussed it, and he said, well, let's release it nationally. And he flew us to Chicago, and I released it in Chicago, and the news picked it up and ran it nationally. We went back, and I testified before the Rockefeller Commission about conspiracy and probable involvement of the CIA. And while I was there testifying for a couple of days, Geraldo Rivera's people called me and asked if I would be interested in doing his show and showing the film.
And I thought about it. Good Night America show?
Right. That was ABC TV. And I thought about it for about a second and a half. I said, sure, let's do it. And the rest is history. I showed it. The public outrage seeing this and seeing that the whole thing was a cover-up caused a lot of people, a lot of witnesses to right to that congressman, gained a lot of support within the House of Representatives to open the case. So I was invited down to Washington, D.C., to the House of Representatives, and I showed the film to congressmen. And within 2 days, resolution was put in to create another investigation, because the Warren Commission was an absolute cover-up. Nobody believed it, except the news media. And when I released it to the Congress, they reopened the case. They created something called the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and they made me staff photographic consultant to that committee. And for 2.5 years, we did an incredible investigation and proved that there was, in fact, a conspiracy. And that's where it all changed. Now, there had been a few times through the history of this case where people had gained a real interest in it. Number one is when it happened. Number two is when Mark Lane released his book, Rush to Judgment, which became a national bestseller. And that opened up a lot of people's eyes. And then when 10 years after the assassination in 1973, there's a movie called Executive Action, starring Burt Lancaster, Robert Ryan, Will Gere. It was a fabulous movie, and its position was that it was a conspiracy and showed how it probably happened. And the book was, I'm sorry, the movie was based on, they said it was fiction based on fact. In fact, it was more fact than fiction.
What's interesting.
That gained a lot of interest nationally, too. And then the next time after that happened is when Oliver Stone released... I'm sorry, I'm going backwards here. I'm sorry.
Backwards with
when
you
Jim
is interesting.
Harrison reopened the case in New Orleans as a investigation of the involvement of a man named Clay Shaw, another man named David Ferry. That was 1967-68, in that period. That gained a lot of interest, too. And then Executive Action gave a lot of excitement from the public's point of view to that. Then when I released the film on Good Night America, that really, really did it. That got the case literally reopened. And the case went on for, the investigation went on for 3 years. When the report came out, they said that it was, in fact, a probable conspiracy. And that was to a 98% certainty, which is nearly 100%. It's almost a guaranteed fact. Well, then the government started fighting back and saying, well, you know, it's a lot of speculation, and they tried like crazy to try to disprove the evidence. What had happened was there was actually a policeman with an open motorcycle radio, and he had recorded the sounds of the shots. You couldn't hear it, because the motorcycle's engine made so much noise it disguised the sounds of the shots. But sophisticated computers could hear the shots, could find them, and highlighted the points in time. In fact, we knew, I say we because I ended up being one of the four people working on the acoustics evidence as well, and we found that there were 11 shots recorded. The House committee leadership tried to reduce it, and they brought it down to 7 shots, just arbitrarily releasing some of them from the overall sound pattern. In some cases, there was a stronger probability of some of the ones that they did release from the overall amount. And the reason why they did that is because the shots were fired too close together to have come from the same weapon. Anyway, I was given the opportunity to work on the acoustics evidence, a sound recording of the shots, and superimpose that over a copy of the Zapruder film made from the Secret Service copy, which had no splices in it. It was untouched. And we found that we could find shots in specific areas which eliminated the possibility of the fatal shot coming from behind. Anyway, that's where we left it. We said probable conspiracy, and the government dropped the ball. They never did anything else after that point.
Now, you had mentioned, just to digress a bit, I found it interesting you brought up executive action with Burt Lancaster, and he was also in 7 Days in May. He might not have come across your path, but I wondered if he had a personal stake in making a movie like Executive Action that he cared about, you know, what had happened because of, you know, the earlier film, 7 Days in May. I believe Rod Serling did the draft of the script for that. But and Will Gear, I believe, was an activist. So some people were starting to get riled up, and you had Dick Gregory in there and Geraldo Rivera. So now, as you walked us through and the House Select Committee wound up and they sort of left it at what they had, in 2023, how does the audio evidence stand up? Because I know everything gets attacked. I mean, you could basically come up with any piece of evidence and they'll come up with a lawyer's brief to attack it. But as of today, how do you think that audio evidence stacks up?
Well, two things. Let me back up for a second. You asked about Burt Lancaster. Burt Lancaster believed in this so strongly, he did his part in the movie at union scale for virtually nothing. That's how much he believed in it. Now, as far as the acoustics evidence goes, the House Committee report was verified. They didn't do a peer review of the evidence. Somebody else has since then, and increased the possibility from 95% to 98%, 98 point something percent, based on the evidence and all of the scientific proof. As far as it goes, the government said, it couldn't be. It was just some other noise. Well, if it's not gunshots, what is it? They never came up with an alternative to what those shot impulses were. In fact, you had an acoustic fingerprint of every shot. You had the muzzle blast. You had the ultrasonic shock wave. You had the echo patterns, and they all fit. So anyone who says that the acoustics evidence didn't count or wasn't valid is crazy.
Well, it is an extreme amount of evidence, and we didn't even get into mentioning Parkland or Bethesda yet, which is quite strong evidence. And on that note, I call over to my friend William Mattson Law. Would you like to jump in, sir?
Hey, Robert, it's been a while since we've spoken.
Ages, sir, ages.
How are you, Bob?
I am doing excellent. Yeah. Two gentlemen on here,
we've got a situation here where there's two people named Robert. We don't know who we're talking to.
Well, you can be Mr. Groden, and I'll settle for Bob.
Very good.
How are you, Mr. Groden?
I'm fine, thank you. And yourself?
I'm well.
Very glad to hear it.
I was 17 years old when you showed that film on Good Night America. And the rest of America, I don't know about them, but it left me stunned. And I really didn't do anything with that until I picked up a book on in the 1980s by a man I know you knew, David Lifton. And that got me interested in it. And I started reading everything I could about Kennedy's assassination, and finally, you know, it drove me, after I'd read every book I could get my hands on, some of the classics you've already named and others, I decided to go to the Plaza, and that's when I first met you, and I think that was either 1996 or 1997, and you were in the Plaza, and I walked up to you, and I had been lugging the whole trip, I'd been lugging The Killing of a President and Search for Lee Harvey Oswald, the big, two big coffee table sized books, and quite heavy. And you were kind enough to autograph them for me. And that's when we met and our relationship began. So all those years when I was a kid and first saw the Zapruder film on TV, and then years later Robert and I would become good friends. So it's good to hear your voice again.
It's great for me too.
Now, William, would you like to probe a little bit into the, your sphere of expertise with Mr. Grodin concerning the autopsy and photographs and Siebert and O'Neill and all the stuff that you've been helping to bring to the public, largely responsible for it with Mr. Grodin? I think we'd like to hear you guys go through that if you'd like to.
So what would you like to talk about on the autopsy, Robert? Got any special thoughts for us?
Well, quite a bit, but I think that, we'll let you handle that because that's your expertise, too. I just want to point out that I was the one who released the autopsy photographs to the public. And
tell that story. Can you tell that story, how they got released?
No. I can't.
Okay.
The last you hear in the background is my wife, Janet.
Okay, then we'll trod gently over that. What interested me so much when I first picked up the book that got me interested in all this was the autopsy photographs. I'd never seen them before, and for anybody that hasn't seen those pictures, they're quite graphic. And at one shows President Kennedy from the chest up, laid out on a morgue table. And others show the back of Kennedy's head, and from different positions you can see the body. And even to my untrained eyes at that point, something did not appear to be right. And so I bought the book and took it home and read it over and over and over again, and to the point where I started probing that, because that was what interested me the most. I thought, surely trained medical personnel who had their hands on President Kennedy's body could tell you whether or not there had been conspiracy. And although the gentleman who wrote the book that I read had done that to some extent, I wanted to have my own experience. And so I started calling these people, and the first person I interviewed was Gerald Custer, who had taken President Kennedy's x-ray. And I spent 2 or 3 days in Pennsylvania and sat across from him while he held up the x-rays and for the camera, and said that what struck me the most, he held up the headshot, the frontal AP x-ray, and said they wanted this man dead, and they did a good job of it. Subsequently, I would go on to interview Paul O'Connor and Jim Jenkins, who helped the doctors in the morgue with President Kennedy's autopsy. And Paul O'Connor, I think Robert can attest to this, was a very gregarious human being, very lively. But he said, matter of fact, that when he was in the morgue and helped take President Kennedy's body out of a metal shipping casket, that all of his brains were blown out of his head. His job that night had been to perform the craniotomy and remove the brain. That was his normal job. He said there was no brain to be removed. And that was really intriguing to me. And he was very adamant in that what was interesting was that he said that he helped remove the president's body from a metal shipping casket. Now, the official version is that President Kennedy's body was placed in a 400-pound Britannia casket lined with plastic to keep the fluids from seeping onto the satin lining of the casket. And then it was taken and placed aboard an ambulance and driven from the hospital and driven to Love Field. And from there was taken to Washington, D.C. and driven to, from Andrews Air Force Base, driven to Bethesda Naval Hospital. But the body, when O'Connor saw it, was in a metal shipping casket. And Jim Jenkins, his partner that night, confirmed that. And so did some others that saw the body in the casket. So there's a whole mystery there of what happened to President Kennedy's body and why the wounds look different. They look different to the medical personnel who worked on President Kennedy to keep him alive than what the body looked like when it first appeared in the morgue to the gentleman that worked over them. The wounds had become enlarged. He had a wound in the back of his head, the size of a large egg or a small orange. He had a hole in his throat about the knot of the tie that Dr. Malcolm Perry in Dallas at Parkland had put a slit over so that they could put a tracheotomy tube in. By the time it reaches Bethesda Naval Hospital, that small wound is now a big open gash in his throat. So the wounds look different. The body came in a different casket, unofficially. I mean, there's all kinds of things that we can talk about and get into concerning the body and the pictures. Talk to us, Bob.
Do you mean Bob okay. or Robert or Mr. Grodin?
Robert is Robert, and you are Bob, so I'm asking you, Bob Wilson.
I knew there was going to happen this way. The thing is this. I interviewed more than 20 of the doctors, the Dallas doctors, the people that actually worked on the body during the life-saving efforts of the president. My newest book is called JFK Absolute Proof. It's a book with 1,000 photographs in it, and in it I interviewed and got the information about the what people saw when they looked at the president's body. And found 79 people that said that the bullet came from the right front and the exit wound was in the back of the head. It's absolute. They knew exactly what they saw, and that the official story later on is just totally different than what every single one of them saw. It's a phenomenal thing. Again, the issues that they got away with is just incredible. They simply buried the truth. And, they buried the truth, and then they buried President Kennedy, and they buried the truth again. Anyway, if anyone is interested in seeing what the doctors actually said, we have a videotape available, a DVD available, which contains the statements of more than 20 of the actual doctors, and what they said was absolutely consistent between every one of them. So there was a massive hole in the back of the head, the size of a grown man's fist. And that's exactly what the doctors all said. The point of the matter is, and what's really sad, is the fact that most of them, almost all of them are dead now. Only one or two are still around. And I released the statements on the videos, on the DVD, that explains, you know, what they saw. And you can see them and hear them say it themselves. I guess by the end of the show, we'll give an address on how you can order it if you want to. Between Bill and myself, we've interviewed darn near everybody that's available to. He got people I couldn't get to, and I got the people that he couldn't get to. So one of these days, maybe we'll be able to put something together with everything.
Bob, is this a new one that you've just put out, or is it the one that you had before?
This is my eighth book on the assassination. This is the third photo anthology. The first was The Killing of the President. The second one is The Search for Lee Harvey Oswald. And this is a new one called JFK Absolute Proof. The first two had 600 pictures each. This one has 1,000 and color throughout. I'm very, very proud of this book. Anyone who's interested in learning about the case and want to see this massive evidence, it's all here. And there are several issues relating to the assassination. Number one, was it a lone assassin or a conspiracy? And the answer is there was a conspiracy, more than one shooter. The second is, was Lee Harvey Oswald a shooter, the shooter, whatever? And the answer is no, he never fired a shot. Number three, if there was a conspiracy, was he part of it? And, you know, if, since the Warren Commission went out of the way to prove that he had no involvement with anybody else trying to prove it was a lone assassin, when we prove that he didn't fire the shots, and there's a lot of evidence there, then since they proved it was not a conspiracy, then he had nothing to do with it and somebody else was involved. Now, we don't know for sure who did it. We know who probably did it. We know what the odds are. We know where the weight of evidence is. But there's so many different issues to deal with. You can prove a conspiracy without any question. I've done it. Bill's done it. A couple of hundred other people have done it. But the thing that's open to some people's minds is, was Oswald part of it? My way of thinking, and considering we have eyewitnesses that he was elsewhere, he did not do it. He was innocent, and they killed him to keep it quiet.
I do want to say that I have all three of Robert's large coffee table books filled with pictures, and I have to say that they are excellent. The photographic record is just incredible, and anybody that really wants to learn about this assassination has to have those. We did a shoot in Chicago in 2015 that Robert was a big part of, and we used absolute proof in that shoot. And maybe you want to talk a little bit about that, Robert.
Well, a friend of ours put together a meeting with several witnesses that were at the autopsy. Phil Singer's his name, and Phil put together this meeting. We held it over several days, and we discussed with medical people what they saw. And as it turns out, they totally back the fact that the Warren Commission was wrong. And they described what they saw, and what they saw is what the Dallas doctors saw, but not what the three autopsy physicians said that they saw. So someday we may be able to complete this project and release all this information. But a lot of the stuff that I've got in JFK Absolute Proof is I think devastating to the Warren Commission's official fiction. And it was an interesting meeting in Chicago. It opened a lot of eyes. We found out for the first time that the reports of a second casket being brought into the autopsy room were not related to the JFK case at all, that there was an Air Force major who was brought in, and his casket was put on the side because President Kennedy's took precedence over it. And that story had never been released before, but all the people that were there, save one, verified that was the story.
The interesting part about that for me was that Jim Jenkins told me that they were told not to do anything with that casket because it was an Air Force major. He'd already been prepped for the funeral, the burial, and he was going to be buried on Monday in Arlington, but they were just holding him over as a waiting station. And then they would take him to Arlington. But at the end of the autopsy, the next morning at Kennedy's autopsy, that casket had then disappeared. It was gone. And so was the shipping casket. So what happened to that? And there were no burials on Monday in Arlington. So I think that was part of a cover story. Yeah. Something going on with President Kennedy's body.
Well, one thing that I found really, really interesting was when I got to interview the Dallas doctors, no one had ever had the chance to talk to them before. The doctors from Parkland were ordered not to to talk about it, or they would be fired and their careers would be ruined. And those that came from the top at Parkland. And
no, I did not know that. I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah, it's true. And the thing is, the naval personnel that that Bill has interviewed were put under orders, under threat of court martial, to keep their mouths shut.
Yeah.
Now, what's really bizarre, when we think about it, is that there were two FBI agents who were there in Dallas and in Bethesda. And they both were very, very open with us. I spoke to one, he spoke to the other. And between the two of us, we got the only interviews with these two people. C. Burton O'Neill are their names. And I spoke to C. Burton, he spoke to O'Neill. No, I spoke to O'Neill, he spoke to C. Burton. And they confirmed that the shot came from the front and the exit wound was in the back of the head. They were very open about it with us.
They both confirmed that the single, they both said the same thing. They said in the same words, the single bullet theory did not happen. They said, Seibert told me, I stood 2 feet from that back wound, and he said that back wound was too low in the back to go in his back, come up and go out his throat. He said that didn't happen. He said the doctors changed their minds about all of that after the body was gone. He said if they changed their mind about that, what else did they change their mind about? And he said when you're doing, this was perfect, he said when you do an autopsy without the body, you're out of medicine and into the realm of magic.
Anyway, the official story was created before the autopsy, and that's sort of a strange thing too. We were hearing from the news media in Dallas that there were only three shots fired. Well, that's not true. Even the government now admits there were at least four, and we know that they had 7 to 8. And in fact, if you go through the acoustics tape by itself and ignore everything else, you've got 11 shot impulses. And that gun, the gun that Oswald was supposed to be firing, could hold a maximum of 6. If there were only 2 empty bullet holes found, 2 shells found initially, and then they added a third one and made it 3. So if there were even only just 4, there had to be a second shooter. And the fact that we had the echo patterns from the acoustics tape prove that at least one shot came from the front, the whole thing goes out the window because the gun couldn't fire fast enough.
Yeah, the working the bolt action, it took, 2.3 seconds just to do the bolt action?
2.3, and in fact, 2 shots were fired, 1.8 seconds that they admitted to. In fact, the last 2 shots, and this we discovered when we did the work on the acoustics tape at the Library of Congress. In fact, the last 2 shots happened 0.7 seconds apart, 3/4 of a second apart. That's impossible. With that rifle, no one else has ever been able to do that or even come close.
Talk to me about your thoughts, Robert, about Clint Hill. You know Clint Hill's story. What do you think about that?
Well, Clint Hill has always backed the official fiction that all the shots came from the depository, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, well, that's his job. That's his retirement right there. I interviewed Mr. Hill in Kansas City several years back, and I asked him where the exit wound was. And he took his hand and he put it right in the back of his head where everybody else said that was where the massive exit wound was. And of the 79 people that I've interviewed and gathered the information from, they were all consistent, every single one of them. Even the two people who changed their story later on initially said the same thing. The shot came from the right front, entered the temporal area above the right ear, and blew out the back of his head slightly to the right of center. Now, this was very, very, very important. But Clint Hill himself said that to me, that that's where the exit wound was. I said, well, where did the shot come from? He said, the book depository. He's not connecting the dots. He knew where the exit wound was, but knew the official story of where the shot originally came from. Now, one thing I want to point out, too, the exit wound in the back of the head is just slightly to the right of the center of the rear of the head. And that seems not to make very much sense for the shot coming from the right front. What we do have, though, is the reality that the exit wound in the back of the head was not in the center of the missing skull piece, but rather at the central end of that big hole. In other words, if you're looking at the back of the head, as you're looking at the back of the head, the exit wound is to the left of the center of the hole in the back of the head. That's where the damage was. As one of the doctors said to me, and he looked at the autopsy pictures when I showed them to him. He'd never seen them before. None of them had, actually. He said, he pointed out to me where a bullet went in the back of the head and where another one exited the back of the head. And he brought us confirmation of a second headshot. So it's there's a lot of interesting stuff here that can be learned. But apparently the news media is not concerned, and anyone with a closed mind who believes the Warren Commission, they never listen to what you have to say anyway. So I gave up on that one years ago.
Bob, do you have any questions for Robert?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember listening to Doug Horn talk about when he was at the AARB, the attitude and the atmosphere and the people who were working at the AARB. And one anecdote he told was kind of stunning. He had turned the corner in a hallway, and as he went, you know, there were a group of people speaking, and one person was saying to the other, you know, what's the difference who killed Kennedy? And, you know, he was kind of stunned that this was a conversation going on, and I think it was an overview of an attitude. But, and of course, the House Select Committee would have been, you know, at a time closer to when the crime was committed, and you also were on the Rockefeller Commission. I was just wondering, as you look back at those two, at the Rockefeller and the HSCA, what were the attitudes like of the people there? Did you feel anyone was really trying, like, aside from people, you know, like yourself, good guys, who was trying to find out what really happened and who might have, you know, been trying to plug up the truth there?
Well, they're two totally different situations. The Warren Commission had a job to do. Their job was to stop the rumors of conspiracy at any cost, and that's what they did. They all knew they were lying, every one of them, without any question. Earl Warren himself said that their job was not to find out who killed the president, but to stop the rumors of conspiracy. Lyndon Johnson had called Earl Warren in, the head of the Warren Commission, before it even existed, and told him that they've got to prove there was no conspiracy, because if there was a conspiracy, who knew how far it would lead? Well, they knew that it could very well lead back to President, the new president, President Johnson, and they couldn't allow that. That's why Johnson created the Warren Commission in the first place. But the House committee was completely different. There were those who knew what their job was supposed to be and others who really wanted to find the truth. That's where it varied from the Warren Commission. Now, I don't know where to begin with this one. Several people who really wanted to find the truth and were really going into it were fired. Others were told to keep their mouths shut. Professor Blakey, G. Robert Blakey, who was the final director of the House Committee. I spoke to him in the hallway one day. He was wearing a gray sweater and he was eating an apple. I remember that very well. I said, Bob, I said, this is insane. You know, the CIA is lying to you. And he looked at me. He said, I've worked with these people for over 20 years. You don't think they'd lie to me, do you? And I said, yeah, I do. And now he found out that, in fact, they were lying to him. And he now says he wouldn't believe a word that they said. But then it was too late. The House committee proved conspiracy to a 98% certainty. But that's after they had eliminated the vast majority of the evidence that proved it. So the acoustics evidence was left to stand on its own. That with eyewitness testimony in the plaza, too. But the fact that there was a conspiracy, and that led to the crime, literally the crime of the century. You know, we hear that a lot, the crime of the century. This really was the crime of the century. And there has never been a complete, honest looking into all this. The very first director of the House committee was Richard Sprague. Politics was maneuvered around him to get rid of him. Then Robert Tannenbaum took over, and he was going to do a great job. He had called me into his office one day and said, Robert, you were right. You were right all along. This is a conspiracy, and it goes to the highest level of government, and we're going to blow it out of the water. And a few weeks later, he was out of a job. So I watched this thing go from good to fair, from fair to good, and then to absolute worst. When I did the work on the acoustics evidence, I found that the evidence was that the shot came from the front. The acoustics evidence, based on the Zapruder film and the acoustics evidence together, the sound recording, showed that the fatal shot came from the front. Well, by that time, they were willing to admit that there was a shot from the front, but they said it missed, therefore it doesn't matter because it didn't kill the president. Figure that one out. But as it turns out, I was right, and the vast majority of the actual congressmen, when I showed them the film, agreed with me. But I couldn't say it. I couldn't back them up that they were right, because I was told that if I said a word about it on my own, that I would be jailed. So I had to keep my mouth shut. I was biting my tongue, but I didn't want to go behind bars. I figured that since they all knew that the shot came from the front for what they had seen, it goes on and on. I can spend hours going over this, but the evidence is there, and anyone with an open mind can see it. If you have any question about it, and it was very self-serving, but I'd say, I'll tell you how to get the book if you want to. JFK Absolute Proof actually goes into a great deal of stuff, including the publication of a letter from the director of the CIA to the head of the Secret Service, admitting that Oswald worked for them. And who he was, how he was trained, where he was trained, where his assignments were, the whole bit. It's a fabulously important piece of evidence. And I've said it should have been written on asbestos. It's so hot.
Well, that's stunning in and of itself. And I'd like to ask about a part of the House Select Committee, one of the reports, the Lopez Report. It seems that someone impersonated Oswald in Mexico City. And by nature of that, if he had met with this Russian agent Kostikov in the Moscow embassy, like alarm bells would have to go off. And I think even good men would be afraid of World War III. Do you find that the Mexico City trip was designed for that purpose? Or what should we think about what happened in Mexico City?
Well, of all the issues that researchers in the case disagree with the most, Mexico City trip is probably the best example of it. I know people that are deeply involved in it that say Oswald did go there. I know others, like myself, that believe he wasn't there. And the other possibility is that even if he was there, somebody else was impersonating him. Ed Lopez, who wrote that report, it's a fabulously important report, and it deals with government involvement in framing Oswald. It's very, very important. It should also be mentioned, relating to that, by the way, that the CIA lied when they said that they did not have tapes of the man's voice who claimed to be Oswald and it wasn't him. They lied about it because the House Committee people did hear about it and they did know about it. But then they said later on that it had been destroyed before they could hear it. That wasn't true.
And the photograph of a gentleman crossing the street from a surveillance camera exists, and that clearly wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald. But had that hit the papers at the time and right after the missile crisis, if it had been shown that, you know, gee, Lee Harvey Oswald met with this agent Kostikov and then Kennedy is killed. I mean, anything could have happened. It seemed like in many ways, a sloppy crime with a lot of angles to pick up on with people such as you two guys have found. But it seems what slammed the lid on it was this sort of national security, which might have, you know, kept quiet until the Lopez report came out, what had happened in Mexico City.
Well, yeah, that's all part of it. There are so many angles to this and so many issues relating to all of this that it would take forever to go through them all, really. And so many things have been resolved. So many things have not been resolved. You know, Bill and I have been going through the medical evidence for years and years, actually decades by this point. I started with the photographic evidence, and then I couldn't stay with just that alone because everything led back toward the photographic evidence and the medical evidence colliding. You know, again, what the doctors in Dallas saw, what the everybody else saw in Bethesda, except for the three so-called autopsy doctors themselves, none of which had ever done a gunshot autopsy ever in their whole careers. Well, what can you say? You know, the government had the possibility of getting the best possible people like Cyril Wecht to actually do the autopsy, and they hired three people that had never done anything. So, you know, what can you say?
Well, I can say that, guys such as yourself and William who dug through to try to give us the truth, it's just quite frustrating to see how much our country has changed for the worse. We would have about 6 minutes left if we end on the hour. I didn't know if you wanted to stay an extra half an hour or what your schedule was.
Bill, how about you?
I'll do it as long as you want, Robert.
All right, let's do another half hour.
I would very much appreciate that. Back over to you, William, and what would you like to pick up at this point in the story?
Well, how did you feel as you're going along and you're working on this Zapruder film and you're finding out all this information that you didn't share with anybody? What were you dealing with mentally at the time when you were doing all that and making all these discoveries?
Well, a lot of it obviously was fear. You know, I didn't want to make it known to anybody because then I'd be a target. Or I felt I could be a target. And when I finally did release the stuff, I really was getting paranoid about it because I kept looking through rearview mirrors to make sure I wasn't being followed when I was driving. And, you know, there's a very real possibility that there could have been severe danger here. You know, here was a conspiracy. I had the proof that it was a conspiracy. Nobody else did. And that made me very, very worried. So after I had released it publicly on Goodnight America, I breathed a little easier because Jim Garrison. When I first met with him decades ago.
Well, tell us about how you managed to do that. Did he get a hold of you? How did that come about?
Well, I got in touch with him. I had started working for a publication in California called Rebel Magazine, which was purely political, and they had set up a meeting with Jim and myself in New Orleans. And when I was at the meeting, you know, we became fast friends immediately. This was like, about 30 years ago, I guess. I have to stop and figure it, but it was in like 1975. Anyway, while we're talking, I asked Jim about, you know, whether he had felt he was in danger. And he said, well, of course it was danger. He said, but I have a rule. I have a law to myself. And I said, what's that? He said, when you learn something, scream it as loud as you can, as long as you can, to whoever will listen. That's your best protection. Once it's out, they gain nothing by stopping you. That became my watchword.
What did you think about Jim Garrison's overall character? There, he's been much maligned through the years by people, saying that he overlooked the mafia, that he was connected to it, that he did this for publicity, that he had visions of having the Kennedy assassination catapult him into the White House. You spent time with him. I never met the man. What do you think about Jim Garrison's character?
Well, he and I were close friends for 17 years, and I think he was absolutely on the right track from the very, very beginning. He had a very, very strong case against David Ferry being involved in all of this, and he learned a bit from Ferry. But when Ferry was killed, he had no one that left to prosecute except the leads he had that led to a fellow who was known as Clem Bertrand, who turned out to be Clay Shaw, director of the trademark, New Orleans trademark. And so he had to go after him. He had no choice. The only protection he had was to keep the issue alive. Once again, following his watchword, scream it as loud as you can, as long as you can. It became a national obsession, and the CIA destroyed the case. They threatened witnesses. They coerced witnesses. They killed witnesses. And so the case got I can't say thrown out. The jury said that there was a conspiracy. They were convinced of that, but they couldn't prove that that Clay Shaw was part of it. So I think Jim was right all along. And there are people who will disagree with me on that. But having worked with him on this for a short period of time, I'm convinced that he was absolutely right.
Did you ever go to New Orleans and look at some of Oswald's stomping ground?
Several times. As a matter of fact, we were there. Jen and I were there last May, and spent almost a week there, and went through all the stomping grounds, everything that still remains. Some of the stuff has been changed, some has been torn down, but we were there with Judith Baker, who was Oswald's girlfriend, mistress, whatever you want to say, and we've become friends with her too, and she's given us a lot of insight as to places that I'll see. It's a funny little thing. There's a little restaurant there, and this place that she and Lee used to go to all the time, and where Oswald used to sit, there's now a little plaque there saying Lee Harvey Oswald sat here. You know, so they remembered him. They remembered him. But yeah, went there several times. Started going back there in 75 and been back at least 8 or 9 times.
So how did that, I'm always interested emotionally with people when you've spent a great deal of your life dealing with this and trying to dig out the truth. Emotionally for you, Robert Grodin, as a person, what's it like to be going to New Orleans, looking at all these, you know, you never thought you would do this. I mean, one thing led to another, and here you find yourself in New Orleans with Lee Harvey Oswald's paramour, for lack of a better word, and you're going around to all these haunts. What's going through your head? What do you feel like when you do that?
Well, the more you do, the more you look into it, the more you get confirmation of what you felt, whatever, the more reassured you are that you were on the right track. I went down some years ago with another researcher, John Armstrong, and we went to all the places where Oswald lived, where all the places where he worked, places where he was photographed. It just brought it all to life. It's like in 1995, I moved down from Pennsylvania to Dallas because there needed to be a voice of reason here. We have the Sixth Floor Museum that backs the single assassin, the lone assassin theory, because the city wants them to, and they do. There were people on our side, but they had no credibility, no history in the case. So I made the decision I was to come down here, and I did. I've been down here for I guess over a quarter of a century now, and I go down to Dealey Plaza nearly every weekend, every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and meet with people, and people want to learn about it, and I answer their questions, and I let them know, you know, I let them see the books and the DVDs and magazines, whatever there is, to give them the information on any level that they're interested in. And I feel we're making a contribution to history. President Kennedy was killed because he was trying to make us a better, safer world. And I feel that we all owe it to him, to his memory, to keep the issues alive and let people know what really happened. And no, we can't bring him back. And it may be too late for justice in this case, but it's never too late for the truth.
You know, you've had to suffer some consequences because of keeping this alive. Would you like to go into that a little bit?
Sure. It's nothing to hide. I started going down to Dealey Plaza and selling, back in those days, it was just a videotape, and then became a magazine and a videotape, then a second videotape, and then on and on and on, and then the books, too. The first being High Treason, the second being The Killing of a President, the third being Search for Lee Harvey Oswald, and now finally what I consider to be the best of the bunch, which is JFK Absolute Proof, which unfortunately is not available in bookstores because it's too expensive a book to print. It's the whole book is acid-free, semi-gloss paper with 1,000 photographs, color throughout, and it was too risky. The book weighs 4 pounds. Shipping it is an expensive proposition. It's $20 to ship it, so it's a problem. But what happened was I started selling in Dealey Plaza, to people, just to support myself, to keep myself with a roof over my head and food in my mouth. And the city wanted me to stop. And they started to harass me and ticket me. I ended up being ticketed 84 times. And during that period of time, they also threw me in jail twice for speaking about the truth. If I had been doing what other people have been doing and backing the single bullshit theory, then I'd have been fine. But it took 7 years. I had to end up suing the city and the Sixth Floor Museum because they were involved in it together. That was the conspiracy. And the proof of that was the fact that they were emailing to each other, high-fiving each other, and talking about how happy they were that I was going through all this. The support I had in the city was the Dallas Observer, the alternative newspaper, and they backed me all the way with this, bless their hearts. Jim Schutz, one of the writers for them, wrote several articles on me and let the public know what was going on. But the Dallas Morning News avoided it.
So give me some thoughts on, you know, when in the Men Who Killed Kennedy, Gary Mack used to be on the side of there was a conspiracy and later changed his mind, later became head of the Sixth Floor Museum. You got any thoughts on Gary Mack and why he changed his mind on all of that?
Yeah, I can answer that for you. Gary was a very good friend of mine for a lot of years. When I was investigating the case through the years, I come down to Dallas Fort Worth, and he let me stay at his house. Well, I lost how many times. He was on our side. He was doing a lot of great investigation on his own. Then it was engineered that he lost his job at the local NBC station. And after he was out of work for, I guess, about a year, the Sixth Floor Museum offered him a great deal of money to be the director. And but he had to sell out. He had to stop talking about the conspiracy. Now they offered him a reported $180,000 a year to do that. This is after they had offered me $320,000 a year to run the place too, to be the actual director. His job was archivist, head archivist. I turned the job down because they told me I would have to stop talking about the conspiracy. You know, it's dirty pool, and I turned it down. He had no choice. He had to go ahead and take it. And it's a shame too, because he was a very nice guy, but he ended up being a real, quote, true believer in the official fiction. But you get him alone, he would still tell you the truth, what he felt and what he knew, but he couldn't do it publicly. They'd have fired him, and he'd be back on the street.
When you started interviewing witnesses, or you started interviewing the doctors and going through what you had to do to interview them, what were their, how did they act when you approached them for interviews? Was it an easy gig, or did they put you off? Did they not want to talk to you at first and then agreed? How did you do that?
Well, it varied. It varied. The doctors were incredibly open about it. Some of them were absolutely phenomenal. For trying to think of the names of the best ones, I know Robert McClelland was one of the very, very best. And there were others as well, but not a single one of them lied to me. Two of them refused to talk.
What
One of them,
do you remember?
who they were?
Yeah,
Oh,
which
God.
two refused to talk to you? Was Pepper Jenkins
Offhand,
one of them?
yeah, he was the first one who refused to do it. But he didn't like President Kennedy. He was an anti-Kennedy guy. So that was pretty much to be expected. I asked him, would he give an interview? He said, "Why? So you can change what I have to say?" I said, "No, I just want to hear what you have to say. I'll publish it no matter what you say." And he said, "Never mind, I'm not going to do it." So he was one. Another was Red Duke, who I think was pretty afraid of it. I've spoken to several people through the years that had spoken with him, where he did share the truth with them, but wouldn't with me. One of the others too, I can't think of who it was. One of the doctors. It would take me a little time to find it, but I asked him about it. He just wouldn't talk about it, period. But all of the others did, and their pictures in the book and their statements, and the actual interviews themselves are on the DVD. I have two DVDs that are out there. Number one is called "The Killing of a President," and the other one is called JFK: The Case for Conspiracy. Oh, there's a third one too, called "The Assassination Films," which is a collection of all the films taken of the assassination.
I have them
Well,
all.
over tw bless your heart. No, seriously, what I've tried to do through the years is to make the evidence available to anyone who really wants to learn and study for themselves. They don't have to believe all my conclusions, but at least see what the evidence is that drove us there. The one real reward I got from being in Dealey Plaza, outside of the satisfaction of trying to do something to remember to let get the president's memory and the issues out,
is I got to meet my wonderful wife, Janet. We met there like 20 years ago, and we got married in Dealey Plaza a little over 3 years ago. And it's wonderful. The connections there are just massive. I just won't go into all of them, but we work together now in the plaza, and it's made my life much happier.
Well, I just want to say to you that when we first met, you were very kind to me, and it meant a great deal to me to meet you and have you be so kind and autograph my books. I had no idea that we were going to be such good friends over the years, and you've been inspirational to generations of people through your work, and I just wanted to take a minute and thank you for that, because you certainly spurred me on. And it all started when I saw the Zapruder film, because you put it on Good Night America. And with that, Bob, I'll turn it back over to you, my friend.
Well, as I watched The Men Who Killed Kennedy going back, I remembered Mr. Grogan coming on and saying, talking about Dan Rather being out of breath, imitating him being out of breath. And saying he was rushed on the air, and he was offered $10,000. He offered for the film, and when they stopped laughing, he said, he was gonna make a lot more than the $10,000. And then my next memory is Good Night America, and I just think of the way the media has handled or mishandled this from the get go. But recently, I was struck watching on YouTube as Tucker Carlson over from Fox News. He came out at, in his opening monologue, and he said, now suddenly he who was always an Oswald lone nutter now suddenly had an epiphany, and he thinks that there was a conspiracy. And, when these people say things like this, my alarm bell goes off and says, well, how are they going to spin this? Where is this going? But be that as it may, I was wondering, as we close out, we have about we have approximately 10 minutes. I was just wondering what you thought of the way the media handled this and the way they're handling it today. I just think the fact that they would persecute you for selling your books in the park, they'd be almost, it's a warning bell to say something is wrong with this. Why would they go to the extent of this trouble to bother you? I think if they had a brain in their head, they would leave you alone. You get, got more publicity having to unfortunately go through those situations. Where they harassed you, you won people's sympathy. But what do you think of the way the media has handled this across the board? And again, I'm sorry what you went through. I believe you said you were approximately 80 tickets and 4 arrests or something to that effect.
84 tickets and 2 arrests. There was another time too when Homeland Security got a phone call from the Sixth Floor Museum that I was a terrorist, and they sent down a little group of their people with machine guns and had me up against the wall.
Jesus.
And they wanted, it was a lot of fun, I'll tell you. Another time is that, about a decade ago, 4 of the researchers, myself included and 3 others, we were all standing on the grassy knoll behind the retaining wall, between the retaining wall and the stockade fence, and we were just talking. All of a sudden, this nauseating cloud came over us, and I turned around and I looked, and here are 2 guys in hazmat suits with hoods on and chemical things on their backs, and they're spraying us. Well, as it turned out, they were spraying us with a chemical called chlorpyrifos, also known as Durbans, it's for killing insects. It's an insecticide, and the thing is that by law, they were supposed to post that they were going to spray ahead of time by 24 hours. They never did. They sprayed us. I kept telling, "Stop! Stop!" And they just kept spraying us. All of us, all 5 of us, ended up in the hospital.
Oh my God!
One died.
And one died. Oh my God. I hadn't heard this. Oh my God.
Yeah, it was pretty darn terrible. And it was actually written up in the Observer when it happened. And I sued the city because of it, but we had a very, I don't know how to say dishonest judge or corrupt judge or whatever. I don't know what to say about it. But she threw the case out of court. She never even listened to the evidence. So the city got away with it. And while I was in the second time I was in jail, they withheld medication from me for a heart problem. And they were laughing about it. So, you know, the Sixth Floor Museum was happy that it was withheld from me. And you know, what can I say? You know, it was such a horrible thing. The arresting officer apologized to me as he was doing it, saying he was just following orders. Well, that's what the Nazis said in World War II, too.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, anyway, you know, the issue is that the case is still alive almost 60 years later. And I'd like to feel that I'm part of that. And I'm very, very proud of that fact. And there are people like Bill who have gone out of their way and spent so long in their own fields of endeavor to try to find the truth about this. And it's very, very important. You know, it's a microcosm of people within the United States and around the world. But there's people from literally every country that are interested in this. And as long as people care and listen about it and want to learn, you know, I'll keep trying to do it. You know, I'm 77 years old now. I'm on my way to 78. And I'll try to keep doing this as long as I can, but it's becoming less easy as time goes by. You know, because of the episode with the chlorpyrifos, I've had breathing problems now for quite some time. Two of them really have severe problems. One can no longer even come to the plaza, and the other one, though I mentioned, died. And it's not been easy. But you know, they say if it was fun, everyone would want to do it.
Well, that certainly does, sounds like anything but easy. But someone dying, and the media barely trembled. I hadn't heard this account before you brought it up. Now I'm terribly sorry that you know, you'd gone through that. But you know, like as William was saying, the work is incredibly important. I think on November 22nd, 1963, our country, you know, changed forever. And you know, it's interesting to see the people who have stepped up. And look at them, you know, yourself included, William included, a long list of people who've gone out of their way to try to tell the truth, you know, often with a lot of suffering and very little gain. So in that, you know, we thank you for being what America is supposed to be about. The heart of America is about freedom and speech, you know.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but basically I want to mention so many of the original true disbelievers in this are now dead, unfortunately. Harold Weisberg, Sylvia Marr, Mark Lane, Penn Jones, and the list goes on and on and on and on. I know of only three people who were active in the case from 63 and 64 through now, and only three of us are left alive that I'm aware of. And I started out much younger. So I had a good head start on it. I started when I was 18. But I wanted to mention, the thought was before you had asked me, Bill, about, and Bob, about whether, you know, what the background was about the city. What did they have to lose or gain or what have you? Well, there was an article in the Dallas Morning News many, many years ago when they still reported about the first time I was arrested, and they said that the city is making a massive mistake by trying to stop us because it brings a lot of people into town for you know, to learn about the case and spend money and what have you. And they should have been doing that, and they weren't. That's number one. But number two, we found out through discovery, through the two legal cases, when I sued the city and the Sixth Floor Museum, which, by the way, after 7 years, I finally won both cases. My attorney is Brad Kazaya, who did an absolutely fabulous job. And no matter how things got worse and worse, he stayed with it, bless his heart. But we found out that there's a group, which people don't even hear about, called Downtown Dallas Incorporated. Their position is that it's bad, bad press for the city to be connected to the assassination. They want it to go away. Well, they're the ones that let it, that the Sixth Floor Museum do what they're doing, and they own the newspapers, they own lots of businesses, hotels, what have you. I offered years ago to do lectures on the case for free for any hotel that wanted to have me be there and talk about it for visitors from out of town. And Downtown Dallas, they got them all to say no. No, they wouldn't allow it. So they're the ones that control all of this. They're behind it all. They have influence over the newspapers, the police department, the whole bit. So that's what we're fighting up against. And it's just been, it's been difficult. It's been uphill all the way. But we're still doing it.
Well, you're still doing it. It still matters to a lot of people, and it keeps hope alive, and it keeps the light shining. And I want to thank you for being on, and also thanks to William for being here. And we have about 2 minutes in that time. Would you like to tell us where the folks can find your books, DVDs, William as well, and where they can look to order those items?
Okay, let me tell you, they're not available in stores because it's just too damn expensive to do it. They've been screwing around with my mail. I had a post office box for years and years, and they've messed around with that one, so I had to close it. I'll give you an address if anyone is interested to order it. You can do that. The address is 534. Well, it's my name, Robert Groton, 534 Branchwood Drive. Branchwood Drive, Midlothian, Midlothian, Texas, 76065. Absolute proof is it's $100, but we'll let it go for $80 for anyone listening to the show who cares to. And it's like $20 to ship it because it weighs 4 pounds. It's very, very heavy, but I'll send them out autographed if you're interested. That's number one. Number two, there are two DVDs available. The Killing of a President and the assassination films. Normally they're $35 a piece. We'll let them go for $20 and $5 for shipping and handling. Again, you know, if you're interested in the case, I suggest them, not because it's just me, but if you want to see what the evidence is that you can't find anywhere else, there are those two things. And I really, really, would like anyone who's interested in the case to get them and let me know what you think. One more time, it's 534 Branchwood Drive, Midlothian, Texas, 76065. You could write to me at robertg1@airmail.net. Robert G, the number one, at airmail, airmail.net. As long as we've got copies of these things available, we'll send them out. We'll fulfill any order that you want. Bob, I want to thank you for the opportunity to do the show. It's always great to try to reach people that may not have heard the issues before. And it's very, very important. I wish we had more like you. Thank you.
Well, it was an honor to speak to you, and I thank William. And William's stuff's available on Amazon.com. But William will be back on the show because we're going to do a show together. And he'll be on all the time to tell you about all his books because we're out of time. put on that one. Thank you so much. I've been waiting to do this one for a long time. Thanks for William for being the bridge to make it happen. I'm honored. It's one off my bucket list. And the Shake and Wake Network, thank you so much for having us. And I hope we can all talk again soon. And don't pass us by, and don't pass me by.